Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. Servanthood, the surprising path to spiritual power. This study of Genesis 24, verses 1 through 41, Judges 19, verses 16 through 21, and Ephesians 5, verses 15 through 33 plunges into the lives of biblical icons Rivka, a.k.a. Rebecca, David's wife Abigail, and the prophets. It uncovers a paradox. True authority emerges from humble service. Explore the delicate dance between respect and truth, as honesty proves the wellspring of genuine esteem. Discover how timeless principles of the soul can revitalize modern economics. At the heart of it all, the bride of Messiah beckons, a call to sacrificial love that transforms both individual and community. Prepare to have your assumptions upended, as this journey upends what we think are the biblical rules of headship.
So we're discussing essentially the nature or the character of individual people being expressed here. You have Rebecca being talked about, obviously, as her first interaction with Rebecca. The man that assisted or tried to assist the traveler with his concubine in the territory of Benjamin. And of course, you have this example in Ephesians about subjecting yourself to a particular head of household or head as Messiah and such in that capacity. So it's geared toward a particular viewpoint, particular topic matter of discussion. That's what it's designed for. So that's what we'll discuss about today. In the case of Genesis, there's a few details to discuss and why this is important. It may seem a little bit unimportant to some people, but it is relevant here. In the case, we start out in Genesis 24, and Abraham, of course, is talking to his Eleazar, his the head of his household, regarding to finding a wife for Isaac. Now, in this instance, it's pretty straightforward. Abraham makes him swear on his male organ parts. This is how it works. And it's pretty standard from both Christian and Jewish perspectives that it's obvious Abraham is making him swear on the circumcision that God had instituted for Abraham and, of course, for Abraham's household and all the descendants of Abraham. And that's because that is the symbol of God's promise that God would establish Abraham, his progeny, his children, as long as God told Abraham, as long as they continue to teach about God to their descendants, that this process would continue. So Abraham's making Eleazar swear on that part of his body to do this. And it's the under my thigh is the most clean, I guess you could turn it, way in which our English translates it. It's refers to the loins of a male, so it's the male's loins. It's his private parts, and it uses again this under my thigh is used again in the Book of Exodus, as well as later on Genesis. Actually, uses it as well for the same exact thing. It's what it is when you gird up your loins, as we find out later on when you're running around, or the priests have to cover their loins up when they're walking up, so they aren't using steps to follow to climb up to God's altar. They have to cover that part of their bodies up so that point doesn't show. So that's what he's being sworn on, and it's based on the circumcision concept. That's the core. That's where it's. And I say that because that's essentially almost universally accepted as that's why he's doing it. I say essentially universal. It's not like there's obviously some straggler, people who disagree, but the vast majority, this is pretty straightforward. It's pretty obvious. Now, what I want to give your attention to is a esoteric concept here, which is interesting to me. It may not be interesting to everybody else, but I'm not a numerologist. I don't really care so much about numerical values of particular words. They don't mean a lot to me. But I will admit, there is some funny things that pop up occasionally, and this to me is a funny thing that pops up. So in the case of this portion that starts out here, that God bless Abraham with everything, right? The word everything. Kahal. So that word kahal, it's supposed to has a numerical value of 52, which is funny. I was talking to my wife about this last night, and it's funny because that's also the numerical value for son, child, and that essentially what this play on numerical values, which again is kind of sketchy, a little esoteric when you deal with numerical values. This play on numerical values essentially is saying everything is no more valuable or less valuable than a child. So everything you have is equal to a child. That's all. And if you have a child, you have everything. There's nothing more you need. Which is consistent with how our Torah and all of our Bible persists this concept is this project, this child, the son continuing on cycle, that essentially is our measured value. It doesn't matter that we have a gold and silver and property. Everything you have is the same as someone who has a child. It's the same thing as far as a biblical viewpoint, which I think is more of a funny haha, but yeah, it's kind of true in many ways, way of life. Not everybody can have kids. I get that, but that's not the point of it. The point is the conceptual idea of a child is your value, is your stuff is equivalent to that value, that they're the same thing. Everything is equivalent to a child and everything you have is everything that God gives you. So that's kind of the idea behind it. Solomon uses his own paraphrasing of that concept when he has blessed man has many many children, his quiver is full of them. I forgot the verse address location, maybe Sales remembers it, but he basically pointed out that this is the blessing of God. Not that God doesn't bless you with other things. Obviously, God blessed Abraham with many things, but one of the primary blessings is that child. And that's according to promise that God gave to Abraham. It's to his children that this process would take place. Hence, when Abraham is now talking to Eliezer regarding finding a wife for his son, how important it is to find the proper or a wife that is suiting for this application. Because in order for Abraham's promise with God to teach his children to continue, Abraham's sons and grandsons and great-grandsons, generations from down the line, also do the same thing. They have to continue on this perpetual process forever. Well, if the sons marry a rotten woman, that's gonna be a harder battle. Just being honest, it's a hard battle. If hence why he doesn't want his son to marry a Canaanite woman there, she's a different religious belief, different viewpoint, different culture, doesn't want that culture brought in because the culture is not going to teach about God in the nature of who God is. Now, so Abraham is very adamant that this promise, the circumcision promise, has to continue on. I need a wife for my son who will facilitate that process. The Canaanite woman, of course, would not be doing that. And we find out later on also with Rebecca and Isaac and their sons about the Esau and the Rebecca's upset about the Esau marrying Canaanite women. And the whole process continues on. It's a really important concept to pay attention to, that it's not just like, oh, the son's all that matters. It's not the son's only that matters. The wife matters too. It matters what the pairing, what the match is super, super critical. If you have a bad match, it's going to be an awful child scenario. The children won't continue on in this process. So it's really important to find the proper or the ideal scenario, the ideal person, I should say, in a relationship. Now, I'm not saying we all find that. I'm not going to discuss people's personal choices in life. It's just that's really the core teaching that we have for being sons of Abraham, whether biological or whether adopted makes a difference. To be that son, you are agreeing to that concept, to agree with you and your spouse to that process of teaching your children that same faith, that same trust and obedience to God and who God actually is. So now we're going to shift over a little bit into the nature, and as we learn about the Eliezer, a little bit about Abraham too, and of course into Rebecca, the woman herself, as we learn our first introduction to her. So first, before we get there too far, so Eliezer, in his conversation with Abraham, they have this dialogue back and forth. So Eliezer says, "Hey, yeah, I'll do all this, but what if she's not willing to come? Should I bring Isaac to her?" And of course, the answer was no. Isaac's not supposed to leave. And I find this part interesting to me. It may not be interesting to everybody else, but it's interesting to me. Eliezer has a, relatively speaking, strong faith. I find it interesting because we don't talk about Eliezer's faith. But he actually does have a strong faith in that what he's willing to find. So he's convinced with Abraham's words, he's convinced he will find a woman. That's not a problem. He'll find a woman that is a proper fit for Isaac. He doesn't know whether or not the woman's willing to, her family's willing to let her leave to go to this new strange territory, meet a bunch of strangers she's never met before. She doesn't know any of them. other than, of course, maybe their name, as she gets told their names. So that's the harder part. He has no doubt he'll find a proper fitting wife for Isaac. That's not his concern. His concern is, what if she doesn't come? What if she's not willing to show up? And she may be a good fit as far as teaching the nature of God, who God is, and a good match. But if she's the character willing to abandon her entire known life and completely flip it, something totally different. And I say flip it because you will learn, remember, you've all read the Torah before, Laban and his household have many gods. They worship gods, okay? That's not an unusual thing. Rebecca most likely also was raised to worship gods, not one, but many gods. So this is a change of her entire existence from what she was raised. I don't know how old she is. Looks from the appearance of her description, she's somewhere in her teens. How she was raised into a completely different religious belief system. It's totally different. Nothing she's familiar with. Other than the fact, okay, there's some weird relatives out there. Yeah, those religious nut jobs in Canaan, yeah, they're way out there. We don't know about them. It's that group she has to join. Okay, it's not an easy thing to choose. And finding a woman who's willing to do that, that's the harder part. And Eliezer was like, yeah, I believe in God. Abraham believes in God, but this whole family is totally a polytheistic, idol worshiping, weirdos. So they have two conflicting cultures that Rebecca is coming from one culture into one she's completely unfamiliar with. That's not an easy transition. I don't want to answer the question, but think about it yourself. Put yourself in her shoes. You were raised a particular religious viewpoint, all right? And your mom, your dad, your aunt, your uncles, your brothers, your sisters, they're all the same viewpoint, same religious perspective. Now I'm going to switch to, I'm making this up, so don't be mad at me, okay, everybody? I'm going to switch to, because it's inflammatory, Islam. You're like, what? As your whole family says, what? Are you crazy? Right. Exactly. Right. So it's not an easy thing to make that decision. I use the extreme Islam. The point is because I was looking for a religion that is extremely different than a polytheistic concept. Now I realize that Islam has its own weirdness. So many Christian groups, every religion does. I just chose one that was extreme. The point is a huge shift from one to the other is the transition we're talking about. Some of you have gone through that shift yourself. My wife went through that shift. I know Sam went through that shift. You've gone through these shifts. I was one thing. I completely, completely flipped from one to a totally unrelated one over here. That is not an easy task to do or process to go through. And you know your stories. You know your experience. You know the heartache, the frustrations, the difficulties along it. It's not an easy thing. It's a kind of character that Rebecca needs to be. The same character that those of you who've done that process, who you are. That's the same character concept. That's what we're trying to discuss and learning about this character person. So Abraham, of course, has a little bit stronger faith than Eliezer. Say, don't worry about it. God will send the lady. She'll come. Don't worry about it. But if for some reason, okay, you need a loophole, fine. If she doesn't come, you can quit. But she's gonna come. Now, this part I want to bring your attention to. Isaac is told, or Eliezer is told regarding Isaac, he's never allowed to leave the land. So he says to stay there within the territory that God promised him. Now, this I find is interesting to me. This may be interesting to some of you as well. So I know that Abraham, though he lives in the territory of Israel, he's not the owner of it yet. He bought a small chunk near Hebron, but reality is God didn't say, okay, now the territory is now currently yours. Everybody else, you're evicted. He didn't give everybody else an eviction notice. They all still live there. So we have roughly Israel's shape. I'm going to do approximate, right? So Abraham's hanging out somewhere around Hebron, which I think is around somewhere around here. I could be wrong. Some of that general ballpark of Hebron territory. I know he moved a little bit when the Dead Sea and Sodom and Gomorrah did their thing. He went to Philistine territory and such, but he's still hanging around the same territory. So basically, Abraham's hanging around Hebron. Now, I do not know for certain, I know it's tradition, where Isaac was almost offered. I know tradition is, it's the mountain where Jerusalem is at today. Can't prove that. Maybe, maybe not. Wherever it was somewhere nearby. So I'm going to, just for the sake of this discussion matter, I'm going to assume the tradition's true. You don't have to agree with this, by the way, but I'm going to assume it's true. So we'll say Jerusalem somewhere around here. Put a big J there. So Isaac was symbolically offered. He didn't actually die, but he symbolically offered. Now, this I find is an interesting concept here. When I discuss this amongst some people, not everybody is interested in it, but some people are. So in this process of offering, what is Isaac offered for? Now think about that. What's he offered for? Now, God doesn't make Abraham go through it, but what's he offered for? There's a test for Abraham, but in the case, for example, uses the symbolism, because we're going to talk about this today, Messiah. We can say, oh, Messiah's offered for our sins to save the people. Yeah, it's pretty obvious, right? No big deal. Isaac, most of the blank. I don't really know, right? He didn't say. It's not spelled. Wait, so why, I don't have an answer for that. You're right. You're not supposed to. Just because. Now, this is what's interesting to me. This is where the symbolism to me makes sense. You don't have to agree with me, but this is how I see it. So when I say, or when we discuss the concept of Messiah, and he's offered for something, he's offered to save the people of God, right? So Messiah is offered, he dies, he's offered, his offering's purpose was to save God's people, the people. Right? So God's essentially is taking ownership to the Messiah's offering, taking ownership of I'm keeping this group of people, right? So it becomes his. So the saved people, these are saved people, from Messiah becomes ownership. God now owns them. God is now, they're mine, I'm going to keep them, so to speak. Messiah owns them too because he's the king, but still the same principle is that's how it's going to work. So in this conceptual idea, the death of Messiah essentially selected or grouped these people together as owned. Those who choose to believe, obviously. You're now owned by both God and our King Messiah. So now we have these individuals who are now owned. We're now under rulership. He is our king, right? That's the idea. In the case of Isaac, the only promise we have regarding this up to this point was the promise of which God gave to Abraham during the circumcision cycle, that process of ownership, of the promise of saving. This people will be saved, this territory will be theirs, this will be their land. So the case of Isaac, his offering, in the same symbolic viewpoint, I'll put Isaac over here, in his offering process, essentially he's not saving people per se, but it's in the land, he's not allowed to leave the land. This was important. Isaac's not allowed to leave the land. But I say this, when these people over here with Messiah, when Messiah now owns them, does he ever leave them? No, he doesn't. Now with Isaac, when he's offered in the land, I'll put the word land here, that's a promise from God. He's now offered, essentially, symbolically, he's offered for the land, for the promise God gave to Abraham. Is Isaac now allowed to leave the land? No. See the symbol? See the connection? See the similes we're discussing here? In this concept, we're actually discussing this process. Isaac's not allowed to leave land, just the Messiah is not allowed to leave the people. They're tied together. Once the offering has taken place, they're now bonded to each other. So in this concept, it's a physical example with Isaac of a spiritual concept with Messiah. It's the same concept. And the idea is that once you've been offered, you Messiah or you Isaac, for this is now yours. You are permanently or intricately or intimately attached to it. It doesn't separate itself. Yes, Kate. She's asking rams. Yes, God said rams. A ram, yeah. So what is rest? She's asking, in the case of, this is totally off topic, but in the case of Isaac, God used a ram that was caught by its horns to actually save, to prevent Isaac's actual death itself. And she asks, what is ram? What's the symbolism of ram offering, a male ram offering for in the Bible? I don't remember all of them, so forgive me. I'd have to go through the list of all of them. But most commonly in Jewish tradition, the rams are offered to prophets. A prophet is a ram. So in the case, and Messiah called himself a prophet. No, not money prophet. Not that kind of prophet, the other kind of prophet. The one who declares or explains God's viewpoints or what God's going to say. So that's the symbolism behind ram in Jewish tradition. And Christian tradition tends to also agree with that, but they're not quite as definitive in their opinion on it. They're a little more wishy-washy. But in Jewish tradition, a ram is a prophet. And Messiah call himself a prophet. So it makes sense why the connection is there. That's off topic. Anyway, so the nature is that what I point out is that Isaac leaves. Abraham says, don't make sure he doesn't leave. He's bonded this land. Unlike Jacob, unlike Abraham, both whom left and came back, Isaac never left his whole life. And all the way through until just before Jacob and his sons traveled down to Egypt, in order, I think, this is my opinion, in order to prevent Isaac from leaving, Isaac dies 1 year before. He dies. And then the next year, they all move to Egypt. Because Isaac's super, super, super old. You can't leave him. He's super, super old. Okay. You don't leave a super, super old guy. So Isaac stays in that his entire life. He never leaves it. There's no record of him ever leaving. And yeah, he goes in and travels around the territory, but always stays in the territory of Israel, or what would become Israel. So Isaac never leaves. Just Messiah never abandons his people. It's the same concept. Now, you don't have to agree with me on that, but that's how I view it. So I'm going to erase this because this is totally not the primary topic of discussion today. I hope I didn't lose anybody on that topic. It's pretty straightforward. Okay, now let's talk into the character and nature of Rebecca, who is our primary subject of discussion today. So the character and nature of Rebecca, in the case of the person that Eliezer is looking for, there's a few characteristic traits we can see based on what we have our text. We don't have everything spelled out. There's certain things we can characterize. First of all, obviously, he's got Eliezer's praying to God when he reaches the well. Hey, it's evening. The girl's coming out. Yada yada yada. And he says the one he's talked to that the right fit, the right person. Now he makes a condition about essentially, I'm going to ask for something relatively simple. This is a simple task. I'm just asking for what I need. I need a drink of water. Just what he's asking for. He's trying to find out. Okay, if I address my need. I'm going to find a person. Is she willing to fulfill my need? Or is she willing to fulfill my need and go above beyond it? What kind of servant nature is she? Where does she value? Where does she see there's a need? I'll fill the need type of person. Or is it goes above beyond the need? So it makes this condition. He's looking for someone who has not just fills the requirement, but is willing to go above and beyond the requirement. Without prompting, no request, no nothing, no, hey, great, good job, none of that stuff, no encouragement, no cheerleading squad saying, yay, 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 along the way, just all of her own. What kind of character is she? It tells us, well, this is the type of character that Eliezer is looking for, which is probably the type of character that Abraham wanted as well. I don't know. They don't discuss the type of character. On top of that, he's not looking for a wealthy woman. Oh, Pamela, your hand is up. Go ahead, Pamela. What do you have? What's your comment? Make sure you unmute yourself so I can hear it, though.
Okay. The ram was caught by his horns in a thicket of brambles, and Jesus was given a crown of thorns to wear.
That's correct. It is a heavy. That's obviously we're talking about the Acacia, which happened a number of chapters ago. It's a heavy laden of messianic reference between all these characters. That's why it's not that hard of a stretch, at least in a Christian viewpoint, to attach them and make the parallelisms pretty easily, because that's how we view our lives. So it totally makes sense to me in my viewpoint as far as why Isaac can't leave the land. That's just how I view it, though. In the case of this nature of Rebecca, when we get to Rebecca, we know the one thing Eliezer is not looking for is a wealthy woman. How do we know? Do wealthy women go out and get their own water? No. They hire people to go out and get the water, right? So Eliezer is not looking for someone who's accustomed to wealth. Now, not that she can't have some money. The point is that that's not his driving interest. It is just, okay, you're willing to do the work yourself. I'm not going to go send servants to go do it. I'm not going to send my assistants, my younger siblings. I'm too old for that. I'm mature beyond this, blah, 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 as siblings sometimes do. No, I'll do it myself. So the first of all, there are certain characteristics we recognize that she's not. She's not an ultra wealthy family. I'm not saying that Laban and Nahor's lion don't have money. That's not their primary thing. They may have some. We find out later Laban does not have all that much anyway when Jacob runs across him. So not a terribly wealthy man to begin with, although he may be a dishonest man, not saying a wealthy man. Don't go hand in hand. So she's not looking for a super wealthy woman. And now he points out, of course, She's very good looking and very young, which implies, again, as I mentioned before, she's probably a teenager. As opposed to Jewish tradition, she's two years old. I think that's dumb. Drawing water real well. Yeah, that's ridiculous. It's just, okay, come on, guys, grow up. But they do it because she brings her nursemaid with her. So, oh, well, you only nurse if you're a baby. No, the nursemaid is with you until you are married. That's how it works. But anyway, that's just a whole, it's a weird Jewish tradition. I don't subscribe to that viewpoint, but just be aware that is out there, that philosophy. Anyway, so she offers obviously to get water for the camels. I know that people have done the analysis, 140 gallons of water, all the stuff she had to do. I don't know how much water the camels, maybe they drank the day before. I mean, not super thirsty, who knows? But you got 10 camels. So they have all this water. She's doing it. And Elizabeth says nothing until she's all finished. And then, of course, you know, lavishes her with these ornaments and such and asks where you're from. Now, this is interesting to me too. You may not find it interesting to me, but it is to me. So in the territory, as it describes Aram, it's actually the Aram between the two rivers. So we're looking at Euphrates and Tigris rivers. So I'll draw a rough map. So Israel's way over here with the Egypt and such. And then we have the Gulf of the Gulf of Arabia way over here. You have, it's a terrible map, forgive me. But this is Saudi Arabia down here. And you have these rivers, you know, these rivers that... I can't remember where Tigris and Euphrates start, and they all go down there. So they're somewhere in this territory between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. That's roughly what, and Israel and you know, Abraham are hanging out way over here in Hebron or Jerusalem. So this rough territory where they're at. So I'm not sure how many days it takes, but I believe traditionally they say 2 to 3 weeks to walk that territory. I assume they traveled the river. I don't know. Anyway, so this is where she's living at. This is where she's common space where she's existing. She's obviously leave this territory and travel all the way back to Israel. Or her case for the first time, going to Israel. Eliezer, of course, goes back. So this is the territory. He has 10 camels with him. And as it records multiple times, he has a number of men with him, which makes sense. You would never travel alone. That would be a really dumb idea. If you don't travel alone with lots of money, with all the camels, one dude hanging around. Jewish tradition, he's all alone, which is contradictory to the actual text. It spells out twice. He has multiple men with him. So it's really weird. Anyway, again, traditions can be sometimes a little odd. So he has at least 10 camels and how many men with them on this traveling route to get to this point. And so in the case of when he offers this stuff to her, she lives in a different household than her brother. I find that interesting. Because she points out she's in the household of her mom. She's in her mom's household, not Laban's household or her dad's household. It's interesting. So in the traditional time period, that time stamp, this time in history, women had in the nomadic and times of Abraham had their own tents, right? Because we have description as Rebecca shows up and meets up with Isaac to get married, he takes her into his mom's tent. Sarah's tent. She has her own tent. Well, she has her own tent, but over here they have their own house. So she gets her house, little house there, and Laban and his, you know, I assume he has brothers. I don't know, he has brothers. He's the oldest. He gets his house. So the house over here is her mom's house. And of course, the dad and his sons get their house. They have their own physical structure. They don't share houses. I think that's interesting to me. It might be interesting to everybody else, but it is interesting to me. It tells you that I'm suspicious that Sarah and Laban probably are not best of friends. They're probably not best of friends in the form of if she's raised in her mom's house, as she describes herself. I'm in the house. She runs to her mom's house to say what's happened, to tell her mom what just took place. It doesn't say she went to her dad's house, but then she then, of course, correlates to Laban, of course, accepts the strangers to his house. But she's living over here in her mom's household, which I think is interesting to me. So her mom finds out the story, what's going on, before anybody else does, other than, of course, her. And then, of course, she relays it and, hey, you know, husband or son, I'm not sure how old her husband was at the time, here's what's going on, and that whole story takes place. Now, this I find of a discussion matter that some people don't like, but I'll bring it up anyway. So Laban is the one who responds. Now, again, we're studying Rebecca, not Laban, but he does respond. He shows up a couple times later on. So Laban, put his name up here. Now, if I'm dealing with, this is a rhetorical question you have to answer, but just think about it, okay? Let's say you're dealing with a dishonest human being. They've been dishonest their whole life. Personal gain or some gain to some level has been their motive their whole life, right? And now they saw us do something good that's appears honorable and wonderful. Do you trust it? Be honest. Don't answer, just think about it. Do you trust it? Now, they've been dishonest their whole life. Okay? Do you trust their motives behind doing something good? Typically, we would say, no way. Are you crazy? The person's lost their whole life. Why would I trust them now? That's ridiculous. Fool me once, fool me twice, that whole saying there, right? So Laban, we don't know much about him prior to this, but we know later on, he's obviously a dishonest human being. So dishonest person later on, we know about, because it describes it very thoroughly how dishonest he was, which we'll discuss some other time. In the case of Laban, he's dishonest. Just because now at this moment in time, he's, oh yeah, no, we have fodder for your, we have accommodations for your camels. Come on in. This is wonderful news. God, this is all great. God, yay, yay, yay. He's been dishonest his whole life. Are you going to now trust him? The answer would be no. I wouldn't trust the guy. He's been, whatever honest, good thing he's doing, probably there's an ulterior motive. I'm not saying there is, I'm saying probably, because we've known the individual for our whole lives. And clearly, when Rebecca is given the opportunity to leave, she said, I'm gone. I'm getting out of here. Okay. So I don't think he's the super honest, wonderful person he appears to be in this part of the story. I say wonderful's a stretch. I get it. But he's not the greatest guy. So whatever motives he may have are obviously not being disclosed, probably would color our viewpoint of him, because we find out later he's not a very good person, regarding what he's doing here in this scenario. So Eleazar, of course, deals with Laban and they say, okay, here's a story. Here's the gold and silver, blah, blah, all the stuff that Abraham, all the story. He tells Laban the whole details. And I was like, hey, sure, yeah, God did it. It's all God's will. Yay, you should go. But then Laban says, let's understand a while. Well, that's for a later part of the chapter, but let's discuss this a bit before we go too much into that part of the story. The point is Laban has his ulterior motives of what he's after. So we're not discussing Laban per se today, but we're contrasting a little bit between him and his sister, Rebecca, because she's not that way. Was it in her personal gain or interest to water all the camels? She didn't know it was. So no, she didn't have any, she had nothing to gain because she didn't know there was some gain here to be had. So it doesn't appear she had. Now, unlike Laban, who finds out, oh, he's really wealthy, now we have personal gain, right? There's a value he's trying to achieve. But up to that point, when she's interacting with a man and a camels and however many men he has with him, she's not looking, it doesn't appear to be, she has any knowledge of any personal gains going to get out of this. She's just plain doing it. And that, again, another character trait we have in this woman we're interested in learning about. So there's we have contrasts of both. She's obviously not going to be a wealthy person because she's doing the work herself. She's not seeing personal gain, unlike her brother who sees personal gain. She's not looking for personal gain. She clearly lives in a different household than her biological father and brothers, which is not uncommon to have males and females separate. There's menstrual cycles. There's reasons we keep them separate. So the reason why we keep them separate, and cleanliness and, you know, guys pee in the toilet seat. Is it all bad stuff? Things you don't want to deal with. Okay. So there's reasons why they're separate, but anyway, so we have a character that's different. So we have a little bit of just a small smidging of knowledge about her character being contrasted a little bit to Laban and, of course, the storyline that they live through. So in the case of her willingness to leave, that gives some a little bit of inkling of pictures was what she is leaving, like what she comes from, what she's abandoning. The idea of switching out your entire viewpoint of life. And what kind of person is this? Now, here is my next rhetorical question concept here. I erase all this because I want to bring this up because I want to. You don't have to. It may not be relevant to most of you, but it's still interesting to me. So in this storyline, we already did a little bit analysis, a little bit of comparison between Isaac and Messiah a little bit earlier, right? So the story, I have a few characters we should write up here. In the storyline with this story, with Abraham, Eleazar, Isaac, Rebecca, Laban, we have people, we have real names of people. So we have Abraham right up here. We have Eleazar, which is his servant, Eleazar. We have obviously Isaac. We have Rebecca. We have Laban. Those are the primary characters. There's other sub-characters too. There's obviously Eleazar has men with him. There are other sub-characters. Rebecca obviously has this. She cites the name of her mom. And her dad apparently is in the part of the story too, but he never says anything. So maybe he's really old. I don't know. There are other sub-characters. But these are primary characters in our storyline here. So I have a question for you. We already compared, and it's not seeming a stretch for those who are Christian philosophies. We already compared Isaac to Messiah earlier, right? Well, in this storyline, if I make this comparison, and who sent Eleazar? Well, it was Abraham, right? To find a wife. Now, Messiah is supposed to be the son of God, or we're all sons of God, but he's supposed to be a particular special character. He gets to be selected as king, the ultimate person who's selected. And Isaac, instead of Abraham, to me, it's not that far of a stretch to say Abraham's playing the character of God in the story. So I'm going to say this. You don't have to agree with me. This is how I view it, though. This time, I'm just doing the comparison. So I'll say Abraham's playing the character of God. Oops. God, not B. God in this storyline, okay? Now, Abraham tells Eleazar, God will send his angel ahead of you to do the work. Eleazar is just doing a servant's work, a job to prepare to find this woman for Isaac, right? And Abraham uses the phrase, God will send his angel go before you. In my opinion, Eleazar is playing an angel's role. Now, if I was an angel's role, so he's playing an angel, that's the angel's, he's a servant, he's a task, an angel's role to go do the job for it. Some would argue in Christianity, we call it the Spirit of God, or God's Holy Spirit, if you want to use it. I'm not a Trinitarian, but some people are. In the case of Rebecca, it's quite obvious, the wife, okay, not shocking. She's supposed to be the girl. So we say, would this be a bride? Okay, so this is not a hard thing to consider. So a bride here, that's her job, right? They're trying to find a bride. So I compare Rebecca to Rebecca. So question for you, who's Laban? Who's Laban? Okay, so what is Laban? He's a liar, a selfish liar, right? And where does Rebecca live? Not directly in his house, but amongst him, amongst the selfish liar. So I personally, Daniel Agee, believe Laban plays a character in the role too. Someone who is in charge of or in the household or somehow influencing Rebecca in her life, right? Who isn't Messiah or God? And who might that be? Take a wild stab. This is a hard one. Who do you think Laban could represent? I would argue Satan or the world. So world or Satan. That's how I would argue it. You don't have to argue it that way. You can see something else. But that's okay. That's how I happen to view it. And then she, Rebecca, says, I have opportunity to leave. I'm out of here. I'm gone. I forget this junk I live with. I'm going to another place, right? That's why I perceive it that way. You don't have to agree with it, but that's how I view it. So in these storylines, I find this interesting concept as far as what's happening here, as far as how to do the task. And of course, the angel prepares Rebecca, decorates her, gets her all ready, informs what's happening before she even met the Messiah or met Isaac. That's the kind of character. So this is how I view it. You don't have to view it the same way, but this is how I happen to view it. So I wanted to point that out to you because I think it's interesting to me. And I also find it interesting that, which is totally, totally unrelated, but I find it interesting too, that Eleazar takes care of his own camels and such in the household of Laban. He gets there and Eleazar's men do the feeding and the washing and the cleaning and everything else. And Laban's like, yeah, the stuff's over there. Have fun. I'm not going to do this work. You are. I think it's comical. Anyway, so this is how I view it. And this is how I, because it colors my viewpoint, this is why I wanted to bring it up to us. So in our discussion of Rebecca being a bride, what is the character of bride? If I use this analogy, this symbolism I'm using here, this transition of characters to to spiritual characters, from physical to spiritual. By the use of analysis of it, what is the point of studying Rebecca? What are we, the body, the church or body of Christ, or body who belongs to Christ? What character are we trying to play in the spiritual concept? Are we trying to play these guys? We're supposed to ideally, in a theoretical Christian viewpoint, it'd be like a bride. That's the kind of the idea who we're supposed to be. So why we study Rebecca's character? That should be our character. That's what we study here. Okay. I'm not saying we're exact like that, because reality is we're not, but some people are more so than others. But that's why that's how I view it. This is why I view this study. The idea is to study what does it nature to be a bride? Now, those of us who are males, we don't tend to relate super well to being a wife. Be honest, we don't. That's not our primary interest. Oh yeah, I'm going to be the best wife I can. That doesn't come to our minds. I'm just being honest, it doesn't. But that's our job. How good of a wife are you? Okay, we should learn about that. Hence, this is a study just as much as it is for wife-type concepts as is for male-type concepts, because that's our job. So now, and we have in the Judges 19, which I'm going to read the whole thing, we already read it once, we have a similar type of character who is a male, a man, doing the same thing a similar thing that Rebecca does with the Ephraimite and his concubine. That story ends poorly, but that's, we don't discuss the end of the story, just that one section. So he himself is showing the same character as Rebecca, though he's male. He's showing the same character as Rebecca, but he's going above and beyond. So the Ephraimite with his concubine was there, that he explained, we have all of our supplies. We have all the food we need. I don't need anything other than just a roof. Guy says, yeah, I'll get you a roof, but I'll also go above and beyond and give you all the supplies you need that you would have used your own stuff. I'm not going to use, I'll supply you with them. So he's showing, that man is showing in Judges 19, he's showing the character, same character Rebecca was showing. That's the type of nature we're learning about these characters. It's not just, here's a need and go take care of it. Observe and see, well, what can I do to make this person's life better? Make it easier. Improve it in some level. That type of nature we're discussing. So when we cover into Ephesians, jump into Ephesians, I'm going to cover this briefly because there's other place I want to go to about this topic. In Ephesians and this conceptual discussion being brought up here about a husband and a wife and the relationship between them and Jesus and the church and the relationship between that, and tries to make this picture all sit in our nice picture book. It doesn't quite fit super well, and we'll discuss why it doesn't fit super well. So in the case of this scenario, in the case of Ephesians discusses, you have a husband, above him is supposed to be Jesus or Christ. And of course, below him is supposed to be the wife. And presumably, at some point in time, there are children. Theoretically, maybe they can't have kids. Who knows? That's the idea, that the symbolism concept of a hierarchical viewpoint of how Ephesians appears to describe it. But we have contradictory information about it from Ephesians. So Ephesians, we have this nature of this head and how this I use this term of a Judeo-Christian viewpoint of how this viewpoint looks. This viewpoint that we have, this diagram which I have up here, this order or sequence of events, is actually inverted. So in our text, so this is how I have Christ atop, your husband down, wife down, but this is how it's described in the book of Ephesians. But it's not how it's described by Messiah. He describes it differently. He inverts this process, which I think is interesting. So in Matthew 20, Messiah inverts this. He says, okay, guys, and he also, his own personal life, showed what the inversion looks like. He pointed out, if those you wish to be ahead, charge of, top, and most important, you have to put yourself as the slave, the bottom end individual. So in this case, even though we have it drawn as head of and go all the way down a sequence of Ephesians, Messiah, as well as the patriarchs, invert this and flip it around. They make the opposite way. They point out, Messiah points out, with in Matthew 20, discuss this process, you want to be the head, put yourself as the slave of everybody. So in this case, we invert this. Okay, Christ, you're at the bottom. Right? Have everybody, right? And everybody that was at the very bottom. You're the foundation. You're the servant, the slave of everybody. And then to go, quote, I use her to loosely up or become lower than Christ, you go up to the husband. Who would then, the husband has to be a slave to his wife and his kids, right? That's his job. Servant to slave, same word. So then the husband is a slave to the wife and the wife is a slave to children. See how it's inverted? This is the description given by Messiah. This is how it's supposed to work. And it's interesting. We have this, that this is, it flips in our mind. We think, well, but is that what that's supposed to mean? That's exactly what it's supposed to mean. Messiah put, if you wish to be the head, you must put yourself as the slave of everyone, the bottom end. And we don't usually look at slaves as being a great thing. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I don't think of slavery as a wonderful thing. Maybe some of you do, but I don't. I think, well, that's kind of bottom down there. That's, I don't know, who wants to be that? Well, that's what he's pointing out. So Messiah pointed out, this is how it's supposed to look. And that's how the process is supposed to theoretically function. Now which is inverted on our description of Ephesians, but reality is this is what Messiah said, and I'll trust the Messiah's description explicitly more so than my understanding. So that's how it's supposed to functionally work. My F's are terrible. Anyway, now in the case of the patriarchs, we have a variation, but not that different from this concept. And we also have a simple example for Dick King David as well, and what this looks like in this slave servant type concept. The case of patriarchs, which is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in the case of, we'll just use, pick one of them. So since we're talking about Isaac, we'll choose Isaac. Okay, we'll choose Isaac. So the case of Isaac and Rebecca, he's supposed to be the slave or servant to Rebecca, right? So we'll put her up here. That's what makes him greater than her, is being her servant. And now when she's struggling, we find out later in the next chapter, when she's struggling with kids, can't have kids, I'm barren, yada, yada, yada. And Isaac says, okay, I'm going to pray with you. I'm going to serve you by praying with you about this problem. And then God responds. So that's how he serves. So he prays with her. This is the opposite of her, means he's facing her. Like we're facing face to face for 20 years in praying. 40, I think it's 20 years, maybe 40 years. I forgot how many years it is. She's barren for so many years. I think it's 20 years. And so she's barren for 20 years and waiting and waiting and waiting. And he's facing her opposite. He's praying with her as her servant to help her. He's not barren, right? She is. So he's, she's barren. I need to serve her to help her not be barren, right? That's the idea of servants, right? So he's serving her in this storyline later on the next chapter. We have a similar type of snare, which we won't cover this time, really, regarding Jacob and his two. I know he has four wives, but he only legally married two. So we're saying he has two wives and two concubines. But so we have Jacob has a similar type of scenario in, like, I forget what chapter, like chapter 31 or whatever it is of Genesis, regarding Rachel and Leah later. So we'll lay up here and Rachel. He says, hey guys, your dad's not cool with me anymore. All right. He's been lying, cheating, stealing, yada, yada. He lays out his whole case and argument of, hey, this is what I've done. This is what the scenario is. God's saying to leave. Are you okay with this? Is it okay? Have I convinced you enough that leaving is a good choice for all of us? And they say, because all of the stuff my dad has goes to our children, because they're serving their children, we'll go. Yes. And that's their argument. Because their priority is their kids. So they put it in, okay, my children, all the stuff dad has belongs to our kids, because it's now ours, our children's stuff now, we'll go ahead and go. And they agree to go. So Jacob even lays out his argument case to his wives and tries to convince them of what they should do. And then they say, okay, based on the evidence you've given to me, we can see from our kids' perspective what's best for them. I'll serve what's best for them. Therefore, let's go. Right? Again, serving kids. So it's the priority shift that takes place, which I find interesting. So, okay, husbands, men, if we're going to be the wife of Christ, so to speak, a wife of Messiah, what is our priority? What's the wife's priority? Her children are. right? That's her priority, is her children. She, her job is to serve her children. So us as brides, if you turn to Lucy as brides, men, what's our responsibility? Our children. Same children, same responsibility of a wife would have. And what was Abraham's responsibility that God gave him? Abraham, I'm blessing you and help you because you will teach your children. So what was Abraham's priority? His children, right? So it makes sense when you look at the perspective of the patriarchs and of course what Messiah said in what this head of household actually looks like. It's the ultimate slave or servant of the household. That's how the priority works. Hope we don't lose anybody on this concept, right? So when we look at ourselves or look at the world around us, or even Proverbs? Anyway, one of the chapters of Proverbs, what part was? They say, oh, they describe the perfect woman and such, or all these, the perfect life. That's supposed to be the perfect husband as well, far as because you're supposed to be a wife of Christ, so to speak. I wouldn't lose it beyond this concept. This is pretty basic stuff. I'm just reiterating what our Bible already describes as far as to be a servant, sorry, to be a head of a household or head of your wife, head of your kids. You put yourself as the lowest person in the household, as a slave of everybody. Your job is to take care of everybody. Now, there's one thing I want to bring up to you as far as how the interaction of wife and husband worked in our biblical text. With, I like this interaction. You don't have to necessarily agree with it, but I like the interaction with David and Abigail. The interaction between those two is interesting to me as far as how he is tempered by the wife's discussion. That's in 1 Samuel 25. I'd erase this real quick because it's not super relevant to this part of our conversation. So when we deal with the interaction between a husband and wife and what that's supposed to, what examples we have, obviously we already discussed the example with Isaac and Rebecca. This is a little bit of the example with Jacob, and which is happens like in verse chapter 31 or whatever, Jacob and his wives. There's a little bit other interesting a tidbit of information as far as the conversation and the responsibility of each character in the storyline, which I happen to think is a more developed concept of what does it mean to be a bride of Christ? What kind of actions do I need to focus myself on to be that character, to be the person that Messiah said, yeah, that's the one for me. And God says, yeah, that's when I pick. I want to be that person. Obviously, I get that Rebecca had to go above and beyond what was necessary. So write some of these things down. So in the case of a bride of Christ, Rebecca, there is a need. You fill the need. That's obvious. That's a given. You fill the need. But you have to go beyond the need, observe and go beyond the need and serve the next thing that also could use and you can do to help that. And your priorities is, of course, as a wife's priorities, your children. So you see a need, you go beyond the need, but also priorities as children. So we have to teach them and obviously take care of them. So that is your priority as a wife, so or husband in this case, to teach your children and their ways of God and what is good, what is right, as Abraham was instructed by God to do. In the case, though, I don't know about you, but for me, I'm a human being. And I lose my temper sometimes. Sometimes less and more than others. And sometimes we get a little bit out of hand. It happens. Get mad at our kids or whatever, or life. Things happen, right? Because we're human beings. We're flesh and blood people. It doesn't matter if you're male or female. We all have the same problems, right? So in the case of this relationship between Bride of Christ and Christ, what is the responsibility between both of them? How do they interact with each other? Well, I happen to like the interaction between David and Abigail as my personal comparison. So in 1 Samuel 25, let's jump through real quick just to give you, where is my other book? 1 Samuel 25. Now this interaction may not apply to most of us because, yeah, we aren't all kings. and such, but that's okay. You don't have to be a king to have an interaction, a relationship with God or with Messiah or with your spouse. So, chapter 5, in the case of a story takes place. So, in this storyline, David, he's in the wilderness running from Saul. He does that for a number of years, right? And there's a storyline that's an involving story here takes place. So David, I'll read part of this. I'll jump down a few verses here and there because I won't read the entire thing for forever. It takes a long time. But we'll jump down to verse 2 of 1st 25. This is where our beginning of our understanding of a wrongheadedness by David in what he was attempting to do and how he gets tempered by his future wife. There was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very wealthy. This is verse 2. He owned 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. And it happens in the shearing of his sheep in Carmel. The man's name was Nabal. His wife was Abigail. The woman was intelligent and beautiful, but the man was difficult and an evildoer. He was a descendant of Caleb. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 attendants, and David said to the attendants, "Go up to Carmel, approach Nabal, inquire after his welfare in my name, and say such, success for life. Peace be upon you and peace upon your household. Shalom upon all is yours. And now I have heard that they are shearing for you. Now your shepherds stayed with us and we did not shame them. And they did not lack anything in the days that they were in Carmel. Ask your attendants and they will tell you so. And therefore let my attendants find favor in your eyes. We have come because of your celebration. Please give whatever you can to your servants and to your son David." This is his course came. They spoke in accordance with all the words which entered Nabal's in David's name, and they rested. And Nabal replied to David's servants, saying, "Who is David, and who is the son of Jesse? These days the rebellious servants have increased, and each against his own master. Should I take from my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered before my shearers and give them to men about whose origin I don't even know?" David's attendants returned around to their way, and they went back and arrived. Reported to him in accordance with all these words. And David said to his men, "Each you gird his sword." Each man girded his sword, and David too was girded his sword. About 400 men went after David, and 200 others stayed with the belongings. A young man from the attendants told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master. He drove them off. These men were very good to us. We have not been shamed, nor were we lacking anything all the days we traveled with them. And when we were in the field, they were a wall protection over us, both by night and by day, all the days we were with them, tending the sheep. Now be aware and determined what to do. The evil decree has been made final against our master and against his entire household. He himself is too a base person even to talk to." So Abigail hurried, took 200 breads, loaves, 2 containers of wine, 5 cooked sheep, 5 seahs of toasted grain, 100 raisin clusters, and 200 cakes of pressed figs. And she put them on the donkeys. She said to her attendants, "Go on ahead. Behold, I am coming behind you." But she did not tell Nabal, her husband. Then it happened as she was riding on the donkey, clandestinely descending the mountain. And behold, David and his men were descending the other mountain toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, "It was for nothing that I guarded all this man's possessions in the desert, and there was not missing anything from all that belonged to him. Yet he has repaid my kindness with evil, such that God do to David's enemies, and such shall he do further if I leave over until morning anything belongs to him as much as a dog." When Abigail saw David, she humbled herself. She hurried herself, dismounted from the donkey, and fell on her face before David and crushed herself to the ground. Fell his feet, said, "With me, myself, my Lord, lies the sin. Let your maid servant please speak in your ears and hear out the words of your maid servant. Let my Lord not set his heart against this base man, against Nabal, for he is, as his name implies. Nabal is his name, and revulsion is his trait. And I, your maidservant, did not see my Lord's attendants whom you sent. And now, my Lord, as the Lord lives, and by your life, as the Lord has prevented you from becoming to bloodshed, and from your own hand avenging you, may all your enemies and all those who wish evil upon my Lord be like Nabal. And now this homage that your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the attendants who are traveling with my Lord. Please forgive the sin of your maidservant, for Jehovah has surely make for my Lord an enduring house. My Lord fights the wars of Jehovah, and no blame has been found in you in your days. a man has risen up to pursue you and you seek your life, and to seek your life. May my Lord's soul be bound up in the bond of life with Yahweh your God, and may he hurl away the soul of your enemies as one shoots a stone from the slingshot. And may it be that when Yahweh performs for my Lord all the benefits of which he has spoken regarding you and appoints you as a leader over Israel, that this not be for you a stumbling block and a moral hindrance for my Lord to have shed innocent blood, for my Lord to have avenged himself. And may Yahweh act beneficially towards you, toward my Lord, and may you then remember your maidservant. Stop. So in this conversation taking place, Abigail's not his wife yet. She becomes his wife later, but we'll discuss that in a minute. It's the nature of what she's doing with David. So she's saying, hey, David, wait a minute. What you're about to do is going to kill somebody. This is 1 Samuel 25, yeah. You're going to kill somebody who has not actually murdered anybody. So you're going to kill somebody who has not committed a murder. Now, this is a problem. The Torah doesn't allow you to just kill people because you feel like it. You actually have to have committed a crime worthy of death. And this is where she's pointing out, hey, David, you're going too far. Now, later she has his wife, but the point is that David listens to her reasoning. So he's got his emotional hat on, saying, I'm mad. I'm gonna be mad at somebody. I'm going to hurt somebody. I'm going to kill somebody because I'm mad. I did all this work for nothing. And she's saying, hold it, chill down, calm down, buddy. This is going to be a bad ending for you if you do this. Bad things will happen because you've lost your temper. We don't lose our temper. Good things will happen later. You don't want this to mar your history, your existence, everything about you. This will destroy your character because nothing bad's happened to you thus far. God has taken care of you all along. You don't need to go kill somebody and murder somebody who has not murdered you, who's not tried to kill you. Nabal isn't trying to kill anybody. He just said, buzz off. That's the difference between saying buzz off and committing murder. Nabal didn't commit murder. So she's pointing out, David, you're overreacting. Yes, I realize you're upset. I get that. Here's some food. Here's some stuff that will help you out. But reality is, you don't get to overreact. Don't. You're going over the top. And David replies, okay, yeah, you're right. I was mad. I am mad, but you're right. It is wiser. See, listening to the wife of his counsel of his wife, or soon-to-be wife, it's wiser to pay attention to this counsel. She's a woman. He's not related to her yet. Obviously, Nabal dies and he marries her shortly thereafter. Nabal dies like 10 days later because God strikes him. God kills him, not David. So David's job is not to avenge his own hand. So the point is that in the relationship between this scenario, David, being a human being, was about to overreact to something. He had no business killing Nabal or, as he points out, leaving anything left in his household. So all the males are going to die too or be run off or whatever. He's going to leave nothing alive, right? That was his point. That was his objective. And she's saying, hold it. That's not right. You don't get to do that. That's over the top. That's unnecessary. So it points out in the relationship between this husband-wife team, this husband-wife concept, as him being her bottom-end servant, the one who serves her, he also has a benefit from her in this counseling that takes place. I like this relationship comparison with David and Abigail. Some others may not like it, but I happen to like the relationship comparison. So in the case of husband, which is not her husband yet, husband and wife relationship, what is his benefit as her ultimate servant, as far as her job? His benefit is the counsel and the wisdom that comes from that relationship. Now you find out later, shortly thereafter, I won't read the whole thing necessarily, that Abigail goes back home, informs Nabal the next day because he's drunk. She can't tell him because he's drunk. The next day she tells him, and as it describes, his heart dies inside of him. He's a shell of a man as he realized he was that close to complete other wipeout destruction. He was that evil of his actions. That's what he was. As his name means base or bottom end, that's kind of where he is. So in the case of Nabal's relationship with his wife, his Nabal did not heed or was not responsive to Abigail's instruction, Abigail's act. Now, she saved his life. She saved Nabal's life. So in the case of Nabal as the husband, so I'll put, because both David's her husband later on, but Nabal's husband first. So we'll put both men up here. So you have David up top. I'll put Nabal down below. So in the case of the other Abigail as the wife, she's wise enough to realize what is necessary to get the job done. And she went above and beyond, right? She didn't just sit there and argue with David, this is wrong. She brought a bunch of food. Here's stuff to appease. If five cooked sheep, no, granted, amongst 500 or probably 400 men with him, that won't go very far, but it's something. She is trying to give something. It's something she's trying to appease best she can. And then he gives him an argument, a proof. Hey, a proof text. You can't be doing this. This will destroy your reputation as a murderer now. Instead of a servant of God, you'll be a murderer. You have blood on your hands. Innocent blood on your hands. So David heeds this advice, or so that he marries her. Nabal, of course, when he finds out the voice, you notice he didn't say, oh, Abigail, thank you so much. I was wrong. There was no repentance in Nabal. I was wrong. Here's 500 sheep. I'll just ship them off to David. They're yours. He didn't use 500. It could be 200, whatever it is. He didn't respond as a husband should have responded to the counsel of his wife, right? So Nabal is a bad example of the response. He was a dictatorial type style of husband in this case. It's my way and there's no other way. That's how he kind of treated David's servants. And he died. So Nabal being the dictator style, I'll put a dictator, that results in his personal death by God's hand, right? So God kills Nabal. David, how responded as receiving, okay, yes, you're right. I'll understand the counsel. I receive the counsel. I'll respond accordingly and respond correctly. So David responds correctly. He's, instead of reacting, responds. That's an E, not an R. Correctly responds well. And of course, he winds up living and becomes king and marries Abigail. Along with other, his other wives too. I forgot all their names. Doesn't make a difference. So Dave responds, so he's not her husband yet, responds correctly to the advice that Abigail's giving. Nabal responds completely opposite, is his nature's respond opposite. Of course, he didn't respond when he was had the opportunity to make the correction. He's not corrected. He responded still, hey, I did it my way. He still retained that appearing, retained that same kind of response. That's not a very good husband example, is it? Is Nabal being a servant to his wife? Not in any imaginable way. Now, was Abigail serving Nabal as well as David? Yes, she was. This is interesting. So she took out of her role, went to serve, become the servant, as she said multi-time, your maidservant, the servant to both David as well as Nabal to save Nabal's life from David's hand, that is, and of course prevent David from doing something that was rash. So she's actually took the role, position of husband in this instance as to save their lives as the ultimate servant. So since she temporarily swapped her job and Nabal's job, she became the servant of Nabal temporarily. And God said, yeah, Nabal, you're worthless. You're dead. Go. If you're not going to serve correctly, that doesn't work right. And so Nabal dies. You're not going to respond correctly. So this relationship between a bride and her husband is a really important one that's not supposed to be messed with. It's a very, very core relationship. He is supposed to be a true servant and serve well and be her servant. And of course, with children as the response, as the primary objective here. And I like this relationship comparison because in our study of Ephesians or Genesis or understanding Rebecca, and understanding, of course, obviously later on with Rachel, Leah, the nature of, and Sarah too, the nature of a wife is not just, okay, yes, husband, do whatever you tell me to do. It's supposed to be, hey, we are a team to respond, interact, and take care of our joint objective, which is our children. Because what was Abraham's objective? His children. As a wife's objective would be the children. That's his goal. His focus was children. Hence why he's focused on Isaac, find the proper wife for Isaac, the one that will support this relationship pattern, how it works well. And Messiah point the same thing. You want to be the proper position, you put yourself at the bottom end, and everything else is greater than you are, and you serve them. And that's how you become this proper, caring, responsible, king-like type of character, as Messiah gave that example. So when we study these natures and relationships between our husband and wives, or Jesus in the church, or it is a servant relationship that's the base. It's a core relationship. You are a slave relationship, and the highest person is the slave to those to those who are above them or below them. Above or below, it's kind of weird how we discuss that. But that's kind of how that process is supposed to work. Does it make sense? Did I lose anybody on this discussion matter? I find it interesting to me the way when we discuss a husband and beneath Christ and wife beneath husband and children beneath wife, now that relationship, how that's supposed to work. It's we see that we're beneath, but realistically speaking, beneath means they're on top of you. That's how our Torah, as well as how Jesus describes it. Beneath to means that essentially you're beneath them, another way of looking at it, as far as you are serving them in the common objective or common goal. Does it make sense? It is a lifting up process. You're right. Right. Christ lifts husband lifts up wife, life lifts up children. It is a lifting up process, the nature of service. That's what it's supposed to be. So in the case of Rebecca, what did she do? She was a service to complete strangers, but she lowered herself as a servant. As a result, she becomes a wife of the man who she's serving, as a wife of his master. So by her lowering herself, what did she become? His boss, right? Eliezer becomes subject to Isaac and Rebekah, doesn't he? That's what's happening once Abraham dies. So by bringing herself down, as a result, she ends up, officially speaking, in charge of the individual she's brought herself beneath. So funny how that's supposed to work. But that inversion is an important inversion that God reiterates and spends much time in our Torah, our whole Bible, teaching us. Now, we have distortions in our Bibles too. We have the kings of Israel, kings of Egypt, who have the inverted viewpoint of some of this information. They invert it to where the king is more dictatorial style. And for the majority of them, it turns out very poorly. It just does. Ahab is, okay, we won't go for all the kings, but they have pretty messed up lives, right? So when you invert it to where you become as dictatorial style in nature, which is not what our patriarchs were, nor what our Messiah advocates for, nor what anybody in our religious world, Judeo-Christian world, people advocates for. You have a dictatorial style that is the opposite of what the relationship is supposed to be. The wife does not dictate to the children. She shouldn't be able to dictate to children. It doesn't work that way. Husband does not dictate to the wife. Christ does not dictate to husband, right? Now we have another good example of the exact same scenario, right? With Moses. When Moses, as the Bible in, I think it's Numbers 12, whatever it is, discusses being the most humble man who's ever lived, the most humble person. What did he do? He put himself at the bottom end of everybody. That's who he was. The bottom end of everybody. Everybody has a complaint. Okay, how can I help you with your complaint? How can I serve with your problem? How can I fix your problem? And his father says, no, you're going to burn yourself out. This is nuts. You can't keep doing this. But that's what Moses did. He brought himself down to the very lowest position, helping everybody else with all their problems. Doesn't matter how minuscule it was helping them. He brought himself down to the lowest. So he has all this massive supernatural power that God got him to use. Being the humble himself, he brought himself down at the bottom end, and as a result, was their leader. So that's how that relationship is supposed to work. You put yourself down at the very, very bottom to serve everybody else, and that's how you become the leaders. We have all these examples within our Bible, religious texts, of what that means to be the head, which means essentially in a relationship concept, how you serve people, you put yourself as the bottom. Messiah puts himself as the bottom. Makes sense? Did I lose anybody on this? We'll be here. There's anybody there at Hell Fellowship on this concept. We have multiple examples within our Bibles of the same concept being reiterated many times. I'm not going to go through every single one of them, but this is a pretty standard Judeo-Christian viewpoint when it comes to the being a bride of Christ. On that relationship is to put yourself down at the bottom servant position, whether or not it doesn't matter in the family relationship or anybody else. Rose, you have a question, Rose? Go ahead, Rose.
Yes, I'd just like to lighten the hearts of men thinking of themselves as a bride. When you look at scripture, it says that there is neither male nor female under Christ. There is neither Greek nor Jew. There is neither slave or bond or free. So under Christ, we are all servants of God. So there, there is no male or female. So all you men just rest your neck. Because in the spirit world, there is none of that stuff that's physical. We're here living in the physical now so that we can understand the spiritual, which lies ahead of us. So we're here learning all our lessons in the physical because we're basically pretty dumb. I mean, there's scripture that it's kind of says that we're dumb.
Right.
And so we're here to learn our lessons so that when we enter the spiritual realm, that'll all be behind us. And it'll just be a whole different world.
It is different when it comes to a description given by Isaiah discussing what that world looks like as we become essentially, as Isaiah describes him, a voice or an advisor to people who are still alive, living their lives. And what is the priority of the advisor to someone who's living their life? When you advise somebody, let's say they're having a difficult time in their life, whatever it is, a struggle, a spiritual addiction, whatever it is, your goal is to improve their life, to help them make better choices, right? That's the advisor's job. And in the spiritual world, that's what you're doing. So this concept of priority being the next people who are coming after you is really fundamental. Those to help those others who need help. That's our goal. Whatever advice or guidance or improvement to be the servant to them. So it doesn't have to be a male or female concept. It is a servant position. Abraham took the position, so to speak, after Sarah died, responsible to finding a wife, right? That's would be the wife's, she normally would have a bigger influence in that. We have example of Isaac and Rebecca. Rebecca took the lead on finding a wife for Jacob by telling him what to go do. So he took the job because the priority is, how do I help those who need help? How do I serve them? It's a spiritual concept. How do I improve their lives or get them along their road in a better fashion than what they are currently at, or guide them away from a pitfall that may be coming before them? That's the nature of what it is. And that's an important relationship. That's the kind of bride, that's the kind of person, kind of people, spiritual people that God is looking for his son, who is obviously our king. So yeah, it's not about a male-female concept. It is a priority system, a responsibility, how to deal with others and people around us spiritually and physically. John, you have a question? Go ahead, John.
It's probably a coincidence, but Laban and Nabal, or it looks like they're spelled the same, only inverted. I don't know.
I'm curious if you had any thought about that.
Yeah, most people don't catch that, but you're right that they are inverted. They're inverted spelling, Nabal and Laban. They're inverted spelling for a reason. It's not much of a shocker. They're inverted. So Nabal is a base, like most fundamental, a pleasure-seeking person. That he's a bottom end base of person. And Laban is a word for white, white-skinned guy. But not to say that white skin's wrong, because a lot of us are white-skinned. But the point is, it is an appearance kind of. What do I appear like? I appear clean, and that's the idea behind it. Or appear something that's better than you actually are. You're absolutely right. They are inverted. They're inverted, I believe, for a reason. Not coincidental. I think God was playing with this, and he's being funny. And that these two men are essentially the same person from two different perspectives. One's looking for self gain, and one's looking to retain everything he has. They're both very self oriented individuals. Yes, Sam, you have a question? Go ahead.
Yeah, about the servant being elevated to the to the position of master reminded me of scripture on Luke 12, the parable that the master talks in Luke 12, I believe from 35 to 38. I said, be dressed for service and keep your lamp burning. Then you will be like servant waiting for their master to return from the wedding banquet, so that when he comes and knocks, they can open the door for him at once. So verse 37 says, blessed are those servants whom the master finds on watch when he returns. Truly I tell you, he will dress himself to serve and will have them recline at the table, and he himself will come and wait on them. So, and I think, you know, to sum up all the, you know, the teaching about the being a servanthood, and then, you know, you get elevated.
Exactly. It's a beautiful parable that tells you the exact same thing. It's really, there's a lot of examples in our Bibles about this nature of being a servant and what that looks like and what God is intending for us to do and how, and why he thinks it's so beautiful. I think it's awesome that Rebecca's, it describes her description as far as what she appeared to be, what she, her looks were, but also it's really a beautiful person that we're looking at here. So it's not so much the physical beauty per se, it's what do you do? What kind of work do you do? What kind of help are you giving? That's what makes you a beautiful person in the eyes of our God and the eyes of our King. So both these two characters, two individuals, spiritual beings, what we do and how we serve other people is really what makes us, lifts us up in their eyes and says, yes, this is the person I want. This is the person that mimics God or mimics Messiah in both their respective roles. It's being that person. It's a beautiful, beautiful imagery to understand and see. Any comments or questions? All right, well, I will turn this back over to Jeff. Thank you so much for listening to me.
Yeah, well, great. Thank you. And one of the things we're talking about with, you know, the relationships between husbands and wives with children, et cetera, and people think, well, you know, what kind of other applications does it have? And that's actually what we've talked about here today is the subject matter of Adam Smith's first book about on the sentiments of interactions between nations. His second book is what we know of well, where you get the principles of economics come up. But basically, right, the idea is that if you truly want to serve other people, you are truly serving your market. So when people talk about capitalism being on the realm that Karl Marx puts it of das Kapital, of where you're just looking to capitalize or take advantage, right, of other people, then you are crushing them down. But if you serve those who you want to give your goods to, give your services to, what happens? They come to you. And so thus, this is not something that, well, this is far removed from the, quote, real world. No, far from it. It is integral to the real world that as it should operate, not the you could say, the antagonistic world that looks to seek to take advantage of other people. Because one of the things Adam Smith talked about was comparative advantage, and that is the idea of servants. You serve each other, and so both you lift everybody up in the process. Well, if one takes advantage and is prey upon the other, then what ends up happening? You've got inequality, and right, everything just gets degraded down. So this is not something that's divorced from the whole true world. This is integral to it. So thank you so much for bringing that's that awesome in for a great landing.
Yeah, I've not read Smith's first book. I read his second book.
Yeah, you should take a look at his first book.
Yeah. And what's the title of it again? Do you recall?
I'm trying to remember. It's on the sentiments of something or other, and suddenly it escaped. On moral sentiments.
My daughter knows it. She's studying economics. Yeah. She loves it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that's good. Thank you. These relationships are super. They're super fundamental to being a human being, essentially. It's just the nature of being a human being, a good person. There, how we interact with people is everything about it. Pamela, I see your hand is up. Sorry, Pamela, I missed your question. What was your question?
Not a question. I'm just thanking you for the lesson. It's enlightening to me. Thank you.
Good, good. All right. Well, all right then, Jeff, it's back to you, sir.
I was looking at what you were talking about. That it occurred to me that that's what Messiah said in Mark 9:25. I think he said, "If you want to be first, then you have to be last, or you serve serve everybody."
Yep.
Same kind of idea, right?
Same exact thing. It's the same thing in Matthew 20. Yeah, the same concept. He reiterates the gospels repeated a number of different ways. I think John does his own style of wording it. But yeah, it's super super repetitive, and it's clearly it is a core function that God wants us to learn, and it's honestly it's not isolated just to our New Testament Christian scriptures or the Torah or even the Tanakh for that matter or part of the Tanakh. The prophets also look at the prophets, their own personal lives. What did they do? Now, they weren't like, oh, the glorious, ooh, yay, everybody likes to be a prophet. It was a miserable experience, but they were doing it even at their own personal detriment. Hey, I'm going to do this, even though it's going to kill me. I'm going to do it anyway, because it's the right thing to do to save or help serve anybody who's willing to listen. Our whole prophets, all of them do that, or almost all of them, die for this cause. So it's heavy examples over and over and over again of this service concept. And human beings like me look up to our prophets. Like, wow, look how awesome these guys were, how God spoke them and the messages they have. We look up to them like, wow, these guys are really awesome people. But look what they were doing. They're putting their lives in a line, say, I'm going to die for this. I'm going to tell you what God has to say, even though it's going to kill me. I'm going to put myself as a bottom end, as basically no different than a prisoner. I'm going to tell you what's going on. And they put themselves down low in order to save those few people who are going to listen and say, oh yeah, God did tell us to do what was right and I've been doing wrong. I'm going to change our ways. So the prophets did the exact same thing. All these guys did the same thing. The apostles did the same thing. They all did the same thing. This is a really repetitive concept of put yourself down at the bottom end and everybody else is greater than you, so to speak, as a servant. It's really core teaching.
We have another question.
I look at Abigail. Okay, so you were looking at Abigail as a future wife of David. And looking at Abigail in a little way differently is she is saving her husband and herself by both going and bringing all these goodies to David. At the same time, she says, my husband Nabal is a base man, somehow negative. Yeah. She negatively speaks about him to this other man. Mm-hmm. And so it's not,
tells the truth.
She's not respectful toward her husband in that respect. And yet, and she saves herself and her whole family in that. But I just wanted to bring that up, you know, well, we respect your husband, but she spoke poorly of him.
She spoke truth. There's a difference, isn't there? When you're speaking truth, it's still true. Now, she could lie, but she wasn't. She told the truth. She told exactly who Nabal was. And all of Nabal's servants told her, we know who Nabal is, that they said the same thing about Nabal. It's not like it's a secret. She spoke the truth. See, there's an interesting concept. We have this idea of respect in that, oh, well, we'll never speak the truth about somebody in a given scenario when it's necessary. And reality is, she did what was necessary. She told the truth. And that's where the respect is. For example, let's pretend for a minute that a child says, Mom, Dad, I love you. You did all the good stuff. I did the best you could to raise me. But I'm not going to follow your religious teachings. I'm going to actually follow what the Bible says. And this is where I think is right. And this is what I believe is right. And this is what I should do. And this is what I will do. And even though they're saying the truth, they're not disrespect their parents. Therefore, they're saying, hey, reality is what you guys taught wasn't right. And it isn't right. And still isn't right. And the way of your life isn't right. That's not disrespect, even though it may look like it. It's not. It's telling the truth. So we have to balance the idea of what respect means compared to what truth telling means. And God never lies. He only tells the truth. So and Messiah doesn't lie. He only tells the truth. This would be like God and Messiah. We have to be honest. And that's what she's being. That honesty is a form, actually is the greater form of all forms of respect. Being honest, telling the truth, not lying, not sugarcoating, not altering it to make somebody look better than they really are, just telling the truth. This is what it is. This is how it is. I can't change the facts. This is what the facts are. I'm admitting the truth. in the case of Jeremiah, when you discuss Jeremiah, and he repeats himself over and over again to this entire book, saying, hey, Israel, refer to Israel as well as Judah. If you people, the ordinary people, just admit you made a mistake. He even says over and over again, if you just confess, yeah, I screwed up. I'm not as great as I thought I was. I'm not as great as I pretend to be. Jeremiah points out, if God says, oh, repeat, has Jeremiah word this over and over again, just tell the truth. God says it over again, just admit the truth. If you admit the truth, I'll forgive you immediately. Just admit it. Just admit what is true. Stop lying. Stop trying to make something what it isn't. Just tell the truth. That's all he's asking for. Jeremiah says it through his entire book. Just tell the truth. Just be honest. Be real. Don't fake it. Don't conceal it. Don't try to sugarcoat it. Just be what really is. If it hurts somebody, because the truth can hurt, if it hurts somebody, that may be. Tell them, hey, I'm not trying to hurt you. I'm just telling the truth. This is what it is. That is an honorable position. And according to the book of Jeremiah, as well as Isaiah, it's the same thing, but he says it differently. That is where God says, I value that. That is what matters. Because be honest with you, does God not know the truth? Of course he knows the truth. Men are the ones that conceal it. God knows it. So even though it may look like she's disrespecting her husband, in reality, she's telling the truth. So I don't necessarily see it as disrespect. Obviously, that's a matter of an opinion. So we can obviously see it as disrespect. I see that she's telling the honest truth. This is what it is. This is how it is. It's not a secret. All of Nabal's servants that talked to her said the same thing. It's like, yeah, we know who he is. He's a rotten person. They're all telling the truth too. It's not like it's a secret. It's an open knowledge item. So she's just admitting the truth, just saying, this is what it is. I can't change what it is. She points to David. You can't change. You shouldn't be changing what it is. This is who this guy is. This is how it's going to be. Let God deal with the truth. And she tells the truth. The truth's really an important component, because God reiterates that he doesn't lie. Men lie, but God doesn't lie. The Messiah doesn't lie. He didn't like liars. Liars were not what he was trying to advocate for, even though it may make somebody feel better, to make the look not quite so bad as it actually is. Reality is, you're just concealing the truth. And what good is that? It may make you feel better, may make somebody else look better than they really are, but it doesn't tell the truth. The truth what actually matters. I know this is an opinion concept as far as where respect a line is drawn versus truth line, but to me, truth is really the core. That's the most valuable part you can be when it comes to respecting anybody, is telling the truth. When we deal with people who are alcoholics, right? What's the first thing to do? Admit it. Tell the truth. But it may be offensive, or my kids will be, or my wife will be upset. It doesn't matter. Just admit it. Any kind of a struggling problem, it doesn't matter what addiction is. The first thing you have to do is tell the truth. Admit it. This is who I am. This is reality. This is the facts of the situation. Even though it's going to lower your esteem in the eyes of other people, telling the truth is the foundation of actually getting better, of actually improving. Telling the truth about Nabal gave him, as Abigail explained it, gave him the opportunity to do something about it. Of course, he chose not to, but he had the opportunity and he chose not to take it. Telling the truth is our core beginnings of respect for ourselves and for everybody else around us. Just tell the truth. Don't try to make somebody worse than they are. We're just telling the truth, and not just little bits of truth. Oh, well, I'll tell about this piece, but I'll leave that part out. No, that's not useful. That's not truth. That's intermixing of deceit. Just, this is all the good and the bad. Not just all bad or all good. It's a mix of everything, because we're all mixes of truth, which is both good and bad. So I don't see it necessarily as disrespect, but that's how I see it. Obviously, we have different opinions on this, which is totally fine. I just see it more of truth telling is what she was doing and being honest.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.